Hello and welcome to Pivot to Asia program. My name's John Harrison. A number of events have taken place over the past decade, and particularly over the past year, which threatened the unipolar world that we grew up in, and which was to a great extent formalised by the spirit of the Bretton Woods conferences after the end of the Second World War. Now, some strategists expected the United States to withdraw from its role of the world's policeman, but nobody foresaw the speed and the extent to which this is now taking place, and certainly few envisaged the speed at which major alliances are forming between countries and groups of countries in the East and the South, and the speed at which the East, under China's influence, is literally rewiring global trade across Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and Europe. Now, here I'm quoting from a Valdai Discussion Club paper called The New Global Governance Towards a More Sustainable Framework, and I'm joined by one of the paper's authors, Mr. Yaroslav Lisovolik, the program director at the Valdai Discussion Club and the managing director of research and the chief economist at the Eurasian Development Bank. Welcome to the program, Yaroslav.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, I've read through your excellent paper and you include a vast number of discussion points. Now, if we can, this program, just concentrate on a few. Now, firstly, should we be concerned about an inward-looking America ceding the field to other countries, to other powers?
Oh, I think we should be concerned about a more protectionist America, in the sense that protectionism generates tit-for-tat strategies that are protectionist in nature. Trade traditionally has been one of the driving forces of economic growth and economic prosperity. And if this driving force is no longer there, obviously there are even more question marks with regard to the future growth path of the world economy. And this is happening even as the world is grappling with the new normal phenomenon, whereby it does appear that the world economy is growing at lower growth rates for a longer period of time.
Yeah.
So this is one issue, but the other issue in terms of the redistribution of economic power and economic weight within the world economy from the United States to other parts of the globe, I think this is only natural and is very likely, simply because you have a very significant dynamic development in Asia. Mm-hmm. And this factor alone is accounting for a rising proportion and dominance of Asia in the world economy. And then, of course, the fact that the U.S. is increasingly relying on protectionist strategies, this further leads to the undermining of the role of the U.S. in the world economy.
Right.
Because really narrows the scope for the U.S. to expand the alliances, economic trade alliances across the globe.
Right. Yeah. So it's almost an inevitable process then. I see what you're saying. But at the same time, the world is experiencing problems. I mean, we know about climate change and inequality. And many say that these problems, these kind of problems, can really only be solved by countries coming together and working together. But more and more, we see the opposite happening. And, you know, in line with what you've just been talking about the increasing protectionism. And is this not perhaps the wrong time to be doing this?
Yes. Well, I think you do have a tremendous problem of inequality.
Yeah.
And another problem, which is that there's the inequality in what I call not just the levels of income, but in terms of the quality and the level of integration between developed and developing economies. And while there's a structured, very advanced in the developed world, talking about NAFTA or the EU, in the developing world, there's a lack of structure. There's a lack of coordination among various regional integration groupings. And so one of the main points of the paper is that there is a need for greater coordination, especially across the south-south axis amongst the developing countries, greater coordination among these regional integration projects in order for the integration patterns to be more structured and in order for more impulses to growth and openness to take place in the developing world, even as there's growing protectionist pressure coming from the likes of the U.S.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you're talking about the cooperation between blocks of countries that many people in the West aren't even aware of. But let's carry on. Now, on a sort of more philosophic level, the old order, you know, the one that we grew up in, it was based, I mean, the West at least, based ideas promoted during the old, quote, liberal order. And that was based, I believe, on protecting the rights of the individual rather than the idea or the realist idea of protecting the rights of the state and individuals being more of a quantity that can be sacrificed for the well-being of the state. And it was a major shift. At least that was the story, I believe, you know, within large alliances such as the European Union. And I guess the Americas, North America, that was a one great, you know, these huge blocks. And my question is, perhaps we are moving away from this idea too quickly, and or perhaps concentrating on the rights of the individual was never a sound idea in the first place. I mean, was it always a realist world? And we just convinced ourselves that it wasn't.
Yes, I think what is important to bear in mind for the developing countries, there needs to be a balance of sorts between the growing rights of the individual, and that is something that I think is certainly a proper lodestar, a proper goal for any country, for any state. But that shouldn't take place at the expense of other goals, and certainly on the international arena, the rights of the state and its position, say, if we're talking about a developing country, vis-a-vis other countries, is also very important in that regard. There needs to be a global mechanism, a governance structure that allows for the state, for the developing countries, to have more rights, to have more possibilities to express their will and to pursue the policies that are aligned with their national interests. And I think the issue of national interest needs to be rediscovered in some way for the state in the current setting, because obviously with the old system, it was only the advanced countries that had, you know, the dominance in the global institutions and had the possibility to advance their agenda. And that was done, you know, with a pretext that these are precisely the countries that at the same time are observing the rights of the individual.
Yeah.
Well, that needs to be somehow changed to take into account the possibility for the developing countries to have more of a say and more of a weight in global institutions.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. And of course, then we have the whole idea of R2P, you know, the right to protect, which was something which the Western Alliance and NATO used to justify their invasions of other countries in the name of protecting human rights and so on and so on. But I guess that's really another conversation. But the Chinese, in fact, are preparing this new, incredibly powerful, not just the Chinese, but a group of countries coordinated by the Chinese and the Belt and Road Initiative. And I get the impression that these countries now, which are coming into forming this new alliance, are prepared to sacrifice a little bit or more than a little bit of their sovereignty, and therefore to prepare the way for perhaps that sort of coordination that you're talking about, where human rights can be promoted. But then now we see what's happening, you know, in Europe with Brexit and all this, you know, where the UK government are now trying to pull back its sovereignty. It's having difficulty in doing that, and the arguments are quite well established. But again, do the countries and developing world who are now lining themselves up or being lined up really understand what's going on? I mean, we're talking about a surrender, a few percentage points, perhaps at first, of sovereignty. Are we not?
Absolutely. We're talking about economic integration.
Yeah.
We're talking about some loss of sovereignty.
Yeah.
The degree of this loss depends, obviously, on the scale of integration, etc. But definitely, the experience thus far, it's very likely to be in the future, that integration will involve an undermining of the powers of the state in favor of these regional groupings or these mega blocks that are being built now. And yes, this is the question. But at the same time, I think for the developing countries right now, the question is that perhaps through these new arrangements, through these new blocks that they're participating in, some of the loss in their sovereignty will be compensated by increased possibilities and increased sovereignty in other respects. Because with the old institutions, there was also, with the old pattern of globalization, there was also a loss in sovereignty in terms of the dependency on the dollar, in terms of the dependency on various payment systems in the advanced world. Now, if there is a construct, if there is a structure in which the developing countries can have more scope for their own national currencies, for example, for their own payment systems, for their own regional institutions, the net effect will be not a loss in sovereignty, but actually an increase in sovereignty that can be attained through a different kind of system, a different combination of institutions and regional organizations in which the developing countries participate with a greater alignment with the national goals and national interests of these developing countries.
So, in fact, is the experience that has been gained in the EU and perhaps some of the older geopolitical and economic alliances being studied by these countries now, and they are able to benefit from that experience and perhaps leapfrog some of the problems that we have experienced?
Of course, absolutely. I think the EU project is certainly, I would say, one of the most successful regional integration projects out there. And it's one of the trailblazers in terms of really showing the tremendous possibilities for economic integration that are out there and that could redound to economic growth, to peace, security that we've seen in Europe after the Second World War. I think the EU project is definitely a tremendous success. But if there is an overshooting of integration, if you will, and there are certain things that are, you know, disregarded in terms of the economic fundamentals of this process, then this involves costs. And this is also, this negative experience that the EU had will also be very important for the developing world in structuring its own alliances. And this process is really just starting. I think it's really interesting that there's not that much of a debate within the global academia about what are the ways in which the developing world could really structure its alliances along the south-south axis. I'm really surprised as a researcher that that area is not really explored as much as it should be.
Yeah, well, perhaps it's just because we just don't know anything about it. You know, academia has for the last 60, 70, 80 years really been concentrated on the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, that's where the whites live, isn't it? After all, you know? But anyway, let's take a break here. Welcome back to Pivot to Asia programme. Today I'm talking to Yaroslav Lisovolik, the programme director at the Valdai Discussion Club and the managing director of research and the chief economist at the Eurasian Development Bank, EDB, about the various forms that the new world governance might take. Now, Yaroslav, quite recently you attended the World Economic Forum in Davos, and you indicate in your paper that three different versions of the future world order in terms of economics might appear. Would you mind very briefly outlining what those three major versions are, and also which version or combination of versions you think may triumph, if you like, in the future?
Yes, well, I think in terms of the possibilities that are out there, clearly one possibility is that you you have essentially a status quo, and nothing really changes as much in terms of how the world economy is operating. Mm. Now, that kind of scenario, I think, is starting to become probably less likely, because definitely we're likely to see some kind of changes, significant changes in terms of how the world economy is going to operate. Mm-hmm. And then another scenario is the creation of new institutions along the South-South axis that will gradually shift the balance of power in favor of the developing world. And this is, I think, the more likely scenario, whereby you're going to have the coexistence of the old institutions, the Bretton Woods system, and the institutions of the developing world. There are more and more such institutions that are being introduced. Obviously, the new development bank, BRICS Bank. You have the Asian Investment Infrastructure Investment Bank, and a number of other new institutions that are being launched. And I think to some degree, you may see with time a degree of competition between these new institutions mm-hmm. with the old ones. And perhaps there will be also at the same time some scope for cooperation and co-financing of projects that could be exploited. So I think it's probably some kind of a coexistence framework that we're seeing now, and that is likely to persist into the future.
Right. So Trump's sort of economic nationalism and retreat from the world order is only hastening this process. It's speeding it up. It's making it inevitable, as you were saying at the beginning of the program. I find this absolutely fascinating, this conversation, because it affects our children, our children's children, and their children, and for forever, I think, what's going on right now. But so if I get this right, what you see is sort of, it's not only South-South forms of cooperation, but also South-South plus China and I guess Russia and ASEAN countries, so sort of to a new sort of super mega global movement, you know, SCO plus or BRICS plus, I'm not sure what you call it. It's almost everywhere, isn't it? But apart from the Americas and Western Europe and Australasia.
Yes, well, basically what we're talking about is the possibility for the current projects like BRICS, for example, or the Shanghai Organization of Cooperation to be more inclusive and to have more of an outreach to the developing world. And in order for that to happen, you may have such initiatives as the SCO Plus or the BRICS Plus to try to include more emerging markets and developing countries into coordinating their policies and into having one voice in global institutions.
Yes, what I find very difficult to understand is, I mean, the Western world has, with great, you know, triumph and glory, always proclaimed how its methods through the Western organizations such as the IMF, WTO, so on, have tried to decrease inequality through globalization. But then we found that globalization has not really solved that problem. It's more entrenched the problems of inequality and made third world countries in relation to rich countries even poorer. Now, my question to you would be, okay, so we've got this new scenario unfolding, an incredibly new forms, interesting forms of cooperation between the South and South and China, but what's to stop China, what's to stop the new rich countries in a way doing exactly the same thing as Western countries, as we did to Southern developing countries?
I think at the very early stages of the formation of such platforms and integration groups, this should be one of the guiding questions for the likes of the BRICS, for example. I think if you take the BRICS, the good thing in terms of, you know, the probability that there's not going to be that domination from one country is that it's a multipolar organization whereby you don't have a core and you don't have a periphery. You have five countries from different parts of the developing world advancing their own agenda, acting on the basis of consensus and taking each other's opinion into account. I think this is a very proper foundation for developing a more comprehensive framework, inclusive framework, that does not result in the domination of any one single country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me continue to play the devil's advocate, please. But you could say, in other words, that we're seeing a resurgence of regionalism, and regionalism also has disadvantages, and we look at the global picture.
Yes, absolutely. I think if we're talking about regionalism, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
On the one, it is a challenge to the likes of the WTO and other global organizations. It is also a challenge to the sovereignty of individual countries, as we discussed just recently.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this is also a platform, a building block, if you will, for integration that could be very effective and that could be very productive in terms of advancing integration, especially in the developing world, where there's tremendous fragmentation
mm-hmm.
and the lack of coordination of economic policy. So the argument that we're making in the paper is that one of the building blocks that is lacking in the global governance picture, in the global governance edifice, is precisely this regional layer, the layer of regionalism, which is lacking coordination, which is lacking structure, and we're basically advancing ways and certain formats that could, you know, probably fill in some of the gaps in terms of how regionalism could work in a global setting.
Yeah, I think it's, and just the return of geography, actually. Perhaps rephrase that, return of common sense, that if one country is next to another, it's perhaps a good idea to talk to each other and trade with each other.
Absolutely.
Okay, final question. We are in witnessing the birth of so many new, fantastically exciting economic organizations, institutions, and at the same time, the old institutions are still there. They still carry on, and by all accounts, they're still doing good business, so to speak. Now, but they were based on the old unipolar system, where the new organizations are based on a new multipolar system. My question is, can the old cooperate with the new, or does the old have to self-destruct or be deconstructed, or how will they really modify themselves to the new environment?
Well, my conviction is that coexistence is possible and necessary, and it should not, this process of change should not proceed in extreme and destructive ways. And certainly we are seeing signs that there is scope for cooperation amongst the new institutions, including the regional institutions that are set up by developing countries and the Bretton Woods institutions. So there is, for example, cooperation between the International Monetary Fund and the regional financing institutions that were created in the past decade by the developing countries. And there is significant cooperation between the World Bank and the new development institutions created by China and other developing countries in co-financing projects. It's starting to work, and I think it is the way forward, that the new institutions will learn from the old ones and will try to take whatever best practices there are into the future.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a very good positive note to end the program. So cooperation rather than confrontation. I like that. Well, thank you very much indeed. Once again, fascinating discussion with you, Yaroslav. Always fascinating. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
And just to remind listeners that there's a new paper out called The New Global Governments Towards a More Sustainable Framework, and you can find that on the Valdai Discussion Club website. So thank you very much again, Yaroslav. Thank you very much, listeners, for being this week. Please do tune in again next week. Goodbye.